Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hey, good afternoon. Happy Wednesday, friends. Welcome aboard. This is Afternoons on QR Calgary. My name is Rob Breckenridge. Thanks for being with us here today. We've got a lot of ground to cover. There's a lot going on here on a Wednesday afternoon. Just within the last hour or so, the Federal Heritage Minister has confirmed the federal government has reached a deal with Google. And this is basically at this point now to rescue the Online News Act. So this is a $100 million detail. We'll have details on that coming up this afternoon. A little bit later on, we'll get to the details as well. A big announcement up near Edmonton today, Fort Saskatchewan specifically, a nearly $9 billion project from Dow Chemicals supported by the Alberta government, the federal government. This is going to be a net zero petrochemical plant. We'll have the latest on that. A lot of other stuff to get to this afternoon. Your calls as well, of course, 403-974-8255. We've seen some recent progress on the inflation front. We've seen the inflation rate ease over the last couple of months. Some optimism from the Bank of Canada that maybe things are trending in the right direction toward that 2% target. Food inflation is still lagging. Some indication when it comes to market prices that we will see a further decrease in food inflation in the months ahead. But of course, that doesn't undo all of the inflation we've seen over the last couple of years. We've seen sharp increases in food prices. So even if food inflation eases, you know, we're not seeing food prices drop. So we still have to manage all of those increased costs. And that's been tough on a lot of Canadians, clearly. So what's been driving that? I mean, when it comes to inflation overall, there are a lot of factors. But when we look at food prices, right, there's some more specific factors at play in what's driving the cost of certain commodities and supply chain and the overall cost of the end product. Some important new research out this week from the C.D. Howe Institute. Trying to get to the bottom of all of this, it's called Unpacking the Real Sources of Rising Food Prices. You can read more at cdhowe.org. But joining us on the line this afternoon to talk more about this study is its author, Werner Attweiler, associate professor at UBC, where he holds the chair in international trade policy and has mentioned the author of this report that you can find at cdhowe.org. Professor Attweiler, good to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Rob.
So to what extent can we detach food inflation from overall inflation, right? To what extent does it have its own unique circumstances and causes?
Yeah, it's, first of all, very volatile. It's so volatile that the Bank of Canada actually takes it out of its calculation of core inflation when they set the interest rates for the country. So it has its own dynamic, and it's not only driven by local factors and local production, but also there's an extended supply chain for many goods that we're actually importing, agricultural products from around the world and things that are going into farming, like fertilizers. And so when we look at all of that together, it basically has driven up food prices higher than the overall consumer price index. And that is all the pain we're feeling when we go to the grocery stores.
Yeah, I mean, one of the numbers really jumps out in your paper that overall food prices have risen 24.1% over the course of 4 years. So all of that annualized inflation adds up.
That's right. And there's nothing that actually has gotten cheaper. So all food prices across the board of all the different items that we have been tracking statistically, they have gone up. But what stands out is that there is a lot of differences across the different types of food products that we purchase from the stores.
Right.
Some have gone up a whole lot more than others. And so there are very specific factors that are driving, for example, the increase in the price of fats and oils or the price of wheat as opposed to, say, the price of meats or dairy products.
So maybe we can get into some of those specifics, but if we take a step back and look big picture, what are the big forces or factors that have been driving up the cost of food in recent years?
Yeah, so when we sort of unpack it, first there is climate change and the effect it has on agricultural production and sort of the crops that's coming in every year. There is some variation across locations. There are some regions that have been impacted by weather events and climate change. But there are also then the issues with the supply chain. I mentioned fertilizers, and the price of fertilizers has gone through the roof in 2022, mostly because some of the major suppliers, including Russia, actually were impacted by the global geopolitical events. And then we see higher energy prices that also were a result of the situation in Europe. That has actually spilled over into fuel prices, and all the farmers actually who rely on diesel fuels for their operations had to pay more to actually produce goods that they sell in our grocery stores. And finally, wages are also going up, so labor costs are going up. There have been labor shortages, especially because of COVID first. Farm workers couldn't be brought in that companies relied on. They had to rely on more expensive local workers. And all that has sort of spilled over into these higher food prices. So it's not a single factor that we can point to. There's no scapegoat here. But it's a combination of all these things. And that has led to this picture that is quite different across these different food items.
Well, and certainly, you know, there's political dimension to all of this and attempts to find scapegoats that we've seen from political leaders on both the left and right. The suggestion on one side that there's corporate greed that's been driving up prices. There's suggestions on the other side that it's government taxes, regulations, or the carbon tax specifically that's driving up food prices. So what about those two arguments?
Well, these two arguments actually don't really add up. They cannot explain what we see in the data. They cannot explain the heterogeneity across the board we see across different food items. If it's was just grocery chains all adding up higher margins, we should see this more across the board. And the same as when it comes to fuel prices, we should see the most fuel-intensive products actually gaining more than those that are not fuel-intensive or energy-intensive. But we don't see that in the data. So these explanations just don't hold up. And it's kind of simplistic when you just try to find one reason. Yeah, it's just not that. It's a combination of many different things that is adding up and driving up prices. And that is this big difference that we see across the different food items that cannot be explained by a single factor.
Right. So you don't see much evidence behind the gouging allegation either then?
No. I basically look at the markups in the grocery business, the wholesale and the retail operations, and these margins are actually not that large. Of course, here in Canada, we don't have as many food suppliers as maybe in the United States, but if you look at other jurisdictions around the world, they're kind of similar to Canada. It's relatively concentrated because of our economy of scale in warehouse management and transportation, but the markups are just not that large. Food is such an important item where people can substitute that it's very difficult for companies to drive up prices. There is just not this very strong effect for market structure that we see, for example, in the banking sector or for cell phones.
The situation in Ukraine, I wanted to talk about the impact there. I mean, we don't get, you know, beef or fruit or vegetables from Ukraine, but I mean, Ukraine is a major grain supplier to the world. Russia obviously is relevant. So when Ukraine gets invaded, when there's sanctions on Russia, what's been the impact on commodity prices, on other farm input prices stemming from that?
Yeah, actually, it's transmitted through different channels. First, we have seen this humongous increase in fuel prices in 2022. So that has been a worldwide effect, and that is a major input into farm production. They all require fuel for their operations. So that was the first shock. But we also have seen product coming offline that was produced by Ukraine, namely wheat. And so we actually see a significant effect on wheat prices around the world. And that is affecting Canada too because of the substitution. So it's a global market. And so when there's a shortage that's global, it's driving up prices everywhere. And that's exactly what we see here in Canada, as in other countries around the world. Our prices for wheat have gone up. And we also see the effect on fertilizers, which actually Russia is a major producer. And so this is just missing in the market, and it's basically driving a shortage that is then translating into higher prices.
So some of the differences we see, and maybe there's specific reasons for each, but it does seem confusing to people that why would some fruits and vegetables, you know, why is some more affordable and others have seen big increases? Why are some kinds of meat still more affordable? Others have seen large increases. How do we explain these little differences?
Yeah, so then one has to really look very carefully at each market and the drivers of supply and demand to each market. When it comes to fruit and vegetables, some of them are brought in from particular locations. We can see very strong effects because it's geographically concentrated, and what happens in that particular region in terms of the weather and the climate, that plays a major role. So, for example, when we look at bananas, the price of bananas has risen very little compared to most other vegetables like apples or oranges. So what is the explanation? Local factors, because we're only importing bananas from very specific locations. Same is true for greenhouse products, for example, tomatoes or lettuce. So all of that is coming from these particular locations that are impacted in a unique way, and so we see significant differences. But the good news is vegetables and fruits actually have risen less than the overall average, and other things like beef has gone up more, and pork has actually not gone up as much. So there's a relative price difference in these products because there are unique factors that are driving the production of, say, beef versus pork.
Now, is there some relief in sight? I know some, in sort of looking at, you know, the commodity, the ag, the future markets, you know, suggest that maybe there is some further downward pressure on food prices still to come. Is it too soon to say, or what are your thoughts on that?
The good news right now is that the input prices for farm production are coming down a bit. Energy costs have come down a bit over the course of this current year, and we see also the price of fertilizers leveling off. So there is some stability in coming back into the market, but it's kind of slow. And there are some pressures that actually remain. And the largest pressure I see in the data is in the category that we call edible fats and oils. It includes margarine. These prices have really skyrocketed, more than anything else. And so we were wondering, you know, what is going on there? Why is margarine and edible fats and oils going up like crazy, Spilling over a little bit into the market for butter as well? And the answer is there is actually a policy out there around the world that is supporting the production of biofuels. And biofuels needs feedstock that's coming currently from things such as corn.
Right.
And that is getting into the market for these oils and fats that are used to produce things like margarine. And so this diversion of agricultural output, not into the food market, but into the production of biofuels, is a key factor that's going to keep up prices in that category.
Very interesting. Much more is mentioned, cdhow.org. Werner, thanks so much for joining us here this afternoon. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All the best. That is Werner Andreiler, a professor, associate professor at UBC, holds the chair in international trade policy, and authored this report for the CDO Institute on what's been driving food prices. There's a lot of international factors at play, he says.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome back. Welcome to this hour of the program. Rob Breckenridge with you here, 403-974-8255. You want to join in the conversation. And I want to get some of your thoughts after our next chat here on the whole issue of electric vehicles. Like, what would it take to convince you to buy an electric vehicle? Or maybe you already have. Now, certainly the federal government wants to nudge you in that direction. So we got some new regulations that will be coming into force here, that at least 20% of new vehicles sold in Canada by 2026 need to be zero emission. So basically electric vehicle. And that number rises to 60% by 2030 and 100% by 2035. A lot happening in 2035. So there's that. But in the meantime, you've still got choice. And consumers are voting with their wallets, as it were. Some new research shows that demand for electric vehicles is falling. Now, this is part of what we're seeing in the market. So we saw car prices really get out of hand, you know, 2020, 2021. So there's been some stabilization. So the average used car price, these new numbers from iccars.com, down about 5%. But used EV prices are down 33.7%. So you've seen those prices come down because demand is really dropping. On the other hand, though, there's a steady demand for gasoline vehicles and really steady demand as well for hybrid vehicles. So we've kind of convinced people to go electric, but the hybrid models are the ones that really seem to have appeal. So joining us to talk a bit more about what these numbers are telling us, where consumer demand is going, what the automakers are likely to do in response, and what it means for all of these regulations and that push for electric vehicles. Very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, Carl Brower is an executive analyst at icecars.com. You can read more at icecars.com. Carl, so great to have you with us here this afternoon. Welcome to the program.
Hey, great being on with you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
So this is quite an analysis of not just used or new vehicle sales, but also used vehicle sales. So first of all, what is the data telling us here?
Well, you know, a lot of it points to a similar trend that we've been seeing for a while, which is just a reduction in electric vehicle values and demand and sales. And on the value side, we could point to Tesla and Elon Musk, who really cut the price of his new models. And of course, the used market follows new, and really all of the EV market follows Tesla because he represents such a huge percentage of it. Mm-hmm. So all by himself, by cutting the prices drastically on his new Tesla products over the past year, he's really shattered the used price for his own cars and the new and used prices for other EVs. But what's kind of more interesting and maybe troubling to some people is that in spite of these drops in prices, new and used, the cars are taking longer to sell and they're not selling as many.
Right. And so that's a telling point, because I suppose there's a need to distinguish when we see prices coming down, how much of that is due to a drop in demand, how much of that is due to a lot of these supply chain issues over the last few years kind of sorting themselves out.
Right. And that's exactly right. We're seeing a little bit of a rebalance. I mean, you know, all used cars on average are down about 5% in price compared to a year ago. So that's a sign that, you know, for various reasons, we're starting to balance supply and demand a little more instead of it being so short on supply and high on demand, which it was most of COVID. But, you know, 5% down for the average used car and then 33.7% down for the used EVs, that's more than just a rebalancing of supply and demand. There's a lot more going on there.
Well, there is, and we don't see a similar drop with hybrid vehicles. So there's still a demand, I guess, for some degree of electric vehicle capability, but hybrids seem to be a much bigger selling point.
100%. And, you know, they're down 9.6%, which is more than the 5% for the average used car, but less than a third of the 33.7% for used pure EVs. So hybrids are still doing quite well. When we looked at the fastest selling, we look at like days on market, how long it takes a car to sell. When you look at the fastest selling new cars, 7 of the top 10 are hybrids. So there's a lot of interest in hybrids. And I equate it to kind of the public kind of embracing and figuring this technology out. It really kind of went mainstream 20 years ago with that 2004 Prius. Mm-hmm. But there were plenty of people who were asking questions when there wasn't even such thing as a plug-in hybrid. You know, oh, I don't want to plug it in. What about the battery and all that? Everyone hasn't figured out hybrids, but enough of the consumer buying, car buying public population has figured it out. And so now people are realizing, wow, I pay a little bit more, but not that much more than a pure gas car. I get substantially better fuel efficiency and I never have range anxiety. And if I get a plug-in hybrid, I even get pure EV-like behavior up to 30 to 40 to 50 miles. So on my daily use, I often don't use the engine at all. This is starting to get figured out by people and it's reflected in the hybrid demand that we see.
So what's the difference then, do you think, with demand for straight up electric vehicles and why that's softening?
I think you have all these requirements you need for an electric vehicle. Like, there are so many things that are pushing against electric sales right now. If you think about it, first, they're always more expensive than the equivalent gas car. So you have to pay more for them. And if you're financing a car, which almost everyone does, you got to pay more for the financing because interest rates are, you know, double what they were or more compared to a year and a half, 2 years ago. So you have to pay more and pay more to finance an electric car versus a gasoline car. Then you need a place to charge it at your house, and you probably have to install a charger if you want to use it overnight, not have to use the infrastructure. And then if you want to go and use the infrastructure, a lot of people are running into a lot of the same problems that we've seen for years, whether it's there isn't a charger near them, there's a charger, but it's vandalized, it's not working, there's a charger, but it's not very fast, the pay system doesn't work, there's three people in line in front of me when I get there, so I have to wait a long time before I can start. You have a certain percentage of the population that will push past all of these problems And when we looked at the numbers in terms of market share, we saw that 7 to 10% was kind of the top share in states like Oregon and Washington and California. And then you don't seem to get much higher than that. Like, those states are also growing their share the slowest. So I feel like there's maybe somewhere between 7, 10, 11% of the market that has the ability to get past all this. They've got the space for the charger and the house to put the overnight charger in and the budget to have multiple cars. And so a lot of the other problems with EVs, like the infrastructure, doesn't bother them. But that group buys their EVs, and then you're having trouble getting past that group. And I think that's what we're seeing now. Plus, you add in the economic concerns that people are having. And people don't get less risk-averse. They get more risk-averse
right.
when they're starting to wonder about their employment and interest rates and, you know, what's going on with the economy. And when you're in that mindset where you're not sure what's going to happen, you're not very likely to try a brand new type of technology you've never tried before on a really expensive item.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned states like Oregon and Washington, where they do have winter, and up here in Canada, where we certainly do. And I mean, look, the Canadian government has some, you know, EV mandates coming in the coming years. But, you know, what about those concerns about winter driving and the reliability of battery technology in these EVs?
That's a whole nother issue, and another one that people are rightfully concerned about, because again, you lose a lot of range when you get below certain temperatures, ambient temperatures in the vehicle. And people talk about, well, you can precondition, you can turn on the heater and all that. So, yeah, that's fine. But once you pull out of the garage and start driving, and if it's, you know, 18 degrees instead of even 38 degrees or certainly 68 degrees, you get a whole different level of range from these vehicles. And same thing, you know, on the truck side, you see a lot of people, they've discovered whether it's the cold weather, whether it's towing, whether it's payload, they start using an EV truck as a real truck and not just a device to move themselves around with, and their range drops off. And a lot of people want to point out, well, gasoline cars get worse gas mileage in cold or extreme cold or heat, and gasoline trucks lose half their range when they're towing something super heavy too. They might lose half their range. All that's true. But you solve that problem in 5 to 10 minutes at one of the, you know, tens of thousands of gas stations around you when you're out of range. You don't do that with an electric car. You got to find the charger, hope it works, hope the pay works, hope it's fast charging, hope it's not vandalized, and hope there's not three people in front of you.
In terms of then the automakers themselves, in, you know, responding to what consumers seem to want, there's an appetite for hybrids, still a lot of demand for gasoline vehicles. There's obviously, as mentioned, a kind of a regulatory push to some extent towards electric vehicles. So how are they responding, or how are they likely to respond in the coming years?
There's clearly some kind of reorientation. You know, we just saw some announcements from General Motors this week, you know, talking about they did pretty well in some of their revenue, and now they're maybe going to be reevaluating how hard they're going on the electric vehicle production, the electric battery production, producing batteries. There's definitely kind of a reassessment. There's clearly a reassessment. And I always felt like these manufacturers, you know, they need to say the right thing at the right time, and they need to take the right stance at the right time. And I can't believe they aren't in their own private boardrooms when no one's around running scenarios like crazy, just like the military runs scenarios on various things that could happen in the world. I'm sure they're all running scenarios on, okay, if/when there's an issue with selling EVs, if/when there's a change in the political winds on how hard we're going to push EVs, what's our shift? What's our plan when that happens, if/when that happens? I'm sure they've all been doing that, and they've got them in place. So as is so often the case in life, and certainly in the automotive industry, future plans are always up for reassessment, and we've seen that for decades, and we're going to keep seeing it.
Much more of these data and much more. It's a great resource, iccars.com. Carl, thanks so much for making some time for us here. Really appreciate the insight on all this.
Always great being on with you. Thank you.
Likewise. There you go. Carl Brower, executive analyst at iccars, I-S-E-E, cars.com. So good overview of where demand is going and everything that the manufacturers need to balance here. So, look, if prices are going to continue to come down, I mean, that could actually end up being a selling point at some point for electric vehicles. Because right now, it's cost prohibitive for a lot of people. But there's a lot of risk. You know, when people are buying a vehicle, there's a lot that you factor in, right? What do you need it for? Now, what are your costs? What's the cost of buying the vehicle? What are going to be the cost of driving and maintaining that vehicle? You know, so we got a lot of uncertainty when it comes to electric vehicles in terms of how and where you're going to charge it. What's the reliability as we navigate to the cold winter months? Those are big questions. And so it's understandable that consumers are maybe having some second thoughts. I don't know if governments have fully thought through all of these mandates. One of the texts got earlier makes a pretty reasonable point. Why not include hybrids then? If people are comfortable with hybrids, if they give that reliability aspect, that seems like it's a much easier sell to convince people to abandon, you know, strictly gasoline vehicles. Welcome back. I guess you could chalk this up as a pretty good day for the federal Liberals. The governing Liberals, of course, have had all kinds of political woes as of late and really sinking in the polls. And we'll talk a bit more about some of that. We mentioned before the news out of the U.S., these indictments regarding some India plots, murder plots rather, connected to the Indian government. I think that further vindicates, you know, the controversial declaration the prime minister made a few months ago. You've got word today that the government has reached a deal with Google that salvages part of the Online News Act. There's also a big announcement in Alberta today and everyone putting on a happy face. Announcement of a $9 billion net zero petrochemical facility near Fort Saskatchewan here in Alberta, supported by both the Alberta government and the federal government. Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland was on hand for the announcement today, but one of the questions to her was about her party's leader, the party's faith in their current leader, whether she or others, like Minister Champagne, might see themselves as possible successors.
We have a great prime minister, and my focus is 100% on supporting the prime minister. François Philippe is a fantastic colleague. Randy Boisneau is a fantastic colleague. And I think what you've seen today is a government that has an economic plan, that is delivering investment and jobs and growth for Canadians, for Canadian communities. And as a team, we are all 100% committed to supporting the Prime Minister and working hard to continue to deliver for Canadians. Thanks.
Now, not a surprise. I don't know that anyone would have expected anything different, but those questions are there for a reason. You know, as much as Justin Trudeau has been the face of the Liberals, almost the brand unto himself for the party, Canadians are starting to tire of him. And his own numbers, much like the party's numbers, have been sinking almost into record low territory. New numbers out from Ipsos show about 3/4 of Canadians believe it's time for Justin Trudeau to make way for somebody else. Should Justin Trudeau stay or go? 72% say step down. Even 33% of Liberals say step down. So joining us to talk more about these numbers, very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, Sean Simpson, Senior VP with Ipsos, which, as mentioned, conducted this polling exclusively for Global News. Sean, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
So let's unpack this a little bit more. When you've got almost 3/4 of Canadians saying that the Prime Minister needs to go, what does that say to you, first of all?
Well, what I like to do is track it back to September when it was 60%. So In just 2 months, it's up 12 points. Yeah. So when you understand the sort of severity of the momentum, it sort of brings even more to that figure. And as you noted, 33% of Liberal voters, and that is, by the way, Liberal voters who are still remaining Liberal voters, you know, at 24%, it's much lower than it used to be, think that the Prime Minister should go. So there's, you know, almost an emerging consensus here across Canada that it's time for a new leader of the Liberal Party.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, does this equate to, I mean, is this different than approval versus disapproval? You know, should we distinguish between those two questions or what those numbers might be?
Yeah. Well, and our approval ratings actually aren't too bad. They're in the sort of low or high 30s, low 40s, depending on the day of the week. But those don't usually translate into votes, right? You can say, well, he's done a decent job. He's been around 8 years. You may have agreed to some things. You may disagree with some things. And, you know, you may be saying he does all right. But that doesn't necessarily mean that another couldn't do better and that you don't desire change. And 75% of Canadians say that there should be change in Ottawa, not just, you know, at the prime minister spot, but at, you know, a change of, a change of party. And that's why I think we see the Conservatives at 40% of the popular vote being, you know, one of the primary beneficiaries of the Liberal collapse.
Yeah, which, you know, puts them on track to a big majority government. And it's interesting, too, when you go down the list of some of the big issues and who do you trust to handle those issues, inflation, housing, the economy, the list goes on and on. The Conservatives tend to come out ahead. There are even some issues where the NDP comes out ahead. Not a lot of good news there for the Liberals.
No, and that really is the key to winning an election whenever it comes. It is to demonstrate to Canadians that you understand what's on their minds and that you can help. The Liberal government is not seen as helping anymore. And in fact, on any of the top issues, from inflation to healthcare, housing, the economy, taxes, climate change, the Liberals are chosen as the best to lead on none of them. The Conservatives lead on inflation, housing, economy, and taxes. The NDP lead on healthcare, poverty, social inequality. The Green Party on climate change. And as I said, the Liberals on none. So you can see why they are struggling in the popular vote, because they've essentially lost the confidence of Canadians to fix what ails us.
Right. And I mean, things can change in politics. I mean, you know, talk about a 12-point swing from September. I mean, I'm sure there's the possibility, theoretically anyway, that you could see a 12-point shift in the other direction. But I guess that, you know, the big challenge here is that when you've been in power this long, that's hard to overcome. And we've seen it in the past, right, where Canadians kind of get to a point like, yeah, you've been around long enough. We've kind of had enough of you. I don't know how you counter that.
Well, what new are we going to learn at this point about the prime minister? What sort of positive trait has he been bottling up for 8 years that he hasn't, you know, used yet? So I don't think there are going to be any surprises. I think it would be very, very difficult for him to turn things around at this point, because it seems to have gotten personal, right? It's not just we need a change of government. It's, okay, even if the government doesn't change, we need a new prime minister, you know, because we're in a still technically 2 years away from an election, unless the opposition pulls the plug. It feels a lot like Mulroney, right? It feels like the tide has turned and there's no going back. And the longer that the prime minister stays, I fear the more damage will be done to the Liberal Party. And they're not far away from third place. And if they do drop consistently to third place in the polls, why would the NDP and the other parties continue to prop them up?
It's a big question. Well, we'll see where it all goes from here. Sean, appreciate the overview of these latest numbers. Thanks for making some time for us here.
My pleasure.
All the best. That's Sean Simpson, Senior VP with Ipsos. A new polling for Global News finds yes on the party race. 40% support for the Conservatives, just 24% for the Liberals. They need to be looking over their shoulder. This is the NDP behind them at 21%. It's almost a statistical tie there. So basically, you're fighting to be the opposition party at this point, and what would likely be a majority government based on those numbers. But yeah, the bigger challenge here for the Liberals is how people feel about the leader. Now, if the Liberals change leaders, you know, you'd still have some of these issues. But I think it's to the point where, as much as Trudeau was an asset, feels like he's become a liability at this point for the party. 72% of all respondents think he should go. 33% of self-identified Liberal supporters think he should go. So you hear the answer from Chrystia Freeland. No, he's great. We love him. He's our leader. We support him.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey, good afternoon. Welcome to this hour of the program, friends. Rob Breckenridge with you here on a Wednesday afternoon. A lot more still to get to this afternoon. A very busy Wednesday unfolding here today. You can reach us 403-974-8255, 974-TALK, and we'll get to more of your phone calls and your texts along the way here. Off the top in this hour, though, a story about artificial intelligence and how it's going to play a role in one specific industry. There's no question that AI technology is evolving rapidly. It's going to become more and more relevant to varying degrees in our lives and in various industries. But what about in journalism? What about AI's role in keeping us informed? You know, there's no doubt, and look, as we've been talking about the Online News Act, that the future of journalism is uncertain. It's a lot of evolution and tumult happening in the industry. And so what about AI? You know, can AI be a useful tool, or is AI just going to add to all of the chaos and uncertainty? Well, the center of all of this is a story this week involving Sports Illustrated, which was once a real crown jewel in the world of sports journalism. It was quite an institution. Maybe that's not so much the case anymore, but still, I think there's a certain amount of prestige that goes along with Sports Illustrated. Well, they've been caught using AI. And this is one of those areas in which it raises questions about, I guess, even journalistic ethics. Now, this was first broke by the outlet Futurism, that Sports Illustrated had been publishing articles generated by artificial intelligence without announcing or describing them as having been generated by AI. What made it even weirder was the fact that these articles came with bylines, supposedly written by reporters who had names and photos. Except it turns out those names and photos were also generated by AI. So it does raise a lot of questions. Joining us to explore some of those questions, very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, John Affleck, who's a night chair in sports journalism and society at the Donald P. Bellisario College of Communications at Penn State. Professor Affleck, thanks so much for making some time for us here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, first of all, how surprised were you by this?
I was so surprised that I didn't, initially I thought the Futurism story was a hoax. And then it was only sort of seeing the reactions from the Union of Human Workers at Sports Illustrated, which was aghast, and the statement that came out from the Arena Group, which is now the outfit that operates Sports Illustrated, that I really understood that this had really happened. And like most people, I think I was pretty surprised by it and obviously disheartened.
So what does this represent? I mean, is this an ethical lapse, or how do we describe this?
It's certainly an ethical lapse. I mean, I feel like it doesn't even, in some ways, I feel like it doesn't even rise to the level of an ethical question. You know, journalists in North America abide by the code of the Society of Professional Journalists, and the first the Society of Professional Journalists, and the first item in that code is, seek truth and report it. Mm-hmm. And this was sort of a weird SI adjacent product where they were ostensibly evidently reviewing products and where these articles were being used. And I mean, just the idea that you're not being truthful about how the article is generated or who's doing it just sort of fails the test on its face. I mean, it just isn't even anything to argue about, really.
Yeah, and especially now, the benefit of knowing what we know and going back and looking at some of these articles, like you see some of these, I don't know how to describe it, but very, you know, weird mannerisms, yeah. I guess, almost, that these AI text generators have, that it seems, okay, this, you know, a normal person, normal reporter wouldn't write this way.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with that 100%. You know, my big overall take and where it is that in terms of journalism, is there's a tendency when new technology comes along to, you know, sometimes people won't want to look at it and just want to pretend that it doesn't exist, and others will say, oh, this is it. This is the thing that's going to save us. This is just like the new greatest thing that ever was. And the problem with that, journalistically, and when it comes to the industry of journalism, is that if owners think that they're going to, you know, have an easy way to create content and cut a few corners, it's not going to work out that way. I mean, it's not, you know, we think of AI as omniscient, but, you know, in reality, it's a dumb intern. It's, you know, it makes mistakes. It tells falsehoods. It writes in cliches. And as you're sort of intimating, the structure can just look odd. It doesn't look like a person wrote it. So, you know, interns learn, and the algorithm will learn and mm-hmm. get better as time goes on. But I think all of these are a really good example of the way, as AI develops, that it's going to need human hands to guide it and to essentially act as editors and curators and figure out how to harness it in the best way, as opposed to just, let's let it run free and see what happens.
Yeah, that's the thing. On the one hand, you see how it can be almost a cheap and lazy way to cut costs and just generate content and not have to pay people. But on the other hand, I mean, if deployed correctly, it can be a useful tool in freeing up reporters to focus on certain things as opposed to maybe the more mundane. I mean, there's a lot of data and figures and statistics in sports that maybe AI can be useful in processing. So is there a useful role that you see for it?
I do. There are a few ways, sort of compilation of statistics and that sort of thing. It obviously moves much quicker than, you know, the reporter with a, you know, calculator is going to be able to do things. But there are other ways. An example I'd use is the New York Times has used it in its coverage. This gets away from sports, but you could equally use it there. It's solicited questions on hot topics from readers, for instance, climate change. And then it's taken the family of answers that have come in on what questions do readers have about climate change and broken them down into sort of categories. And then the editors can look at these questions and formulate a question or two that staff reporters can answer. And so that's how they build some of their Q&As, by looking at the large language model, seeing what people are asking, formulating a general question, and then they can answer it. So that's just one small example of how it can be done. When you talk about data, I think ultimately there will be some things to look at over the long haul that could be very interesting about, you know, trends. There are a lot of things you could do in trends in sports and all that sort of stuff, whether it be, you know, how effective is a free agent pitcher, you know, at what age is it bad to re-sign somebody after, you know, for more than a year, that sort of thing. I mean, the stats will tell.
Yeah.
But I think that's the sort of, it's good for sort of deeper look stuff, as an aid to deeper look kinds of writing. I think a question we have to ask ourselves is, if we're just using it for really mundane things, do we need to be doing the mundane thing in the first place? Are people looking at that? So a question for editors to ask themselves.
Yeah, and if nothing else, there's maybe a silver lining here in that it's, you know, thrust all of this to the forefront. It's generating a lot of conversations. I mean, I understand you got your ethics class coming up soon here and an opportunity to really, you know, take a deep dive on these issues, right?
Sure. Actually, this morning what I did was we've got a class tomorrow in my sports writing class where we're going to look at an AI-generated piece against student copy. We had an assignment recently where, just based on statistics and quotes, I asked students to formulate a game story and on a basketball game. And I gave the same material to ChatGPT, and the ChatGPT version is much, much worse than, you know, a paper that would get an A in my class. But it did manage to get where it happened and who won and what the final score was and all that sort of stuff. So it did get the basics of it right. So I'll have the students talk about, you know, what they see in it that they need to make sure is in their work, but also how it's falling short, how something looks when it is really, really, you know, unprofessional. It's, you know, it's a cliche-ridden piece, and so, you know, I think it'll show them how something reads when it's really poorly done, and how it sort of just feels very, makes you feel very negative towards the writer and towards the piece.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it there for now. John, appreciate your input on this. Thanks so much for making some time for us here.
Yeah, happy to do it. Thank you very much.
All the best. Take care. That's John Affleck, Knight Chair in Sports Journalism and Society, the Donald P. Belisario College of Communications down at Penn State. So, yeah, I mean, obviously embarrassing and tarnishing the legacy of Sports Illustrated, which, as mentioned, you know, had a lot of prestige once in the day. You know, I know magazine long-form journalism isn't what it used to be, but still, I think there's something to that brand. This really tarnishes that. So it speaks to kind of where we're at, that this technology is there. It's there for outlets to try to do this, if they can somehow justify it to themselves. I mean, at this point, you don't think highly of your audience if you're going to pass this off as, say, here's our reporter and his latest story. But it does allow for those just kind of, you know, quick, sloppy, lazy articles or content to be generated. You throw it up there. But that's not how things should work, I don't think. I mean, at the very least, be honest about it. Because, yeah, if it's just, if all you need is a very brief summary on, you know, a certain game last night, two or three sentences, then, yeah, maybe that is one way to be more efficient. And allow your staff, your reporters to, you know, spend more time on the stories they're telling. Because ultimately, I think good sports journalism is good storytelling. You know, the scores, that stuff, sure. That's always just been, you know, straight up numbers. And AI can probably really help with that. The presentation of scores and data, especially with, you know, more savvy sports fans these days really craving a lot of those analytics. You know, to have those kinds of tools at your disposal can really help navigate all of that and really help present it to your audience in a way that they can understand. And that would apply to media in general, covering complex topics or, you know, when you got a 600-page budget, those kinds of things. So AI can be a useful tool. But an example here, maybe how not to use it or how we don't want to see it used.
Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Rob Breckenridge. And you can email me, rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.